story. Not long ago, high on a mountain in Idaho, I was living free. So I sold off shotgun to a deputy.
Don't shoot me down.
Don't shoot me down.
Don't shoot me down.
Don't shoot me down. Got a wife and kids on Ruby Ridge. Please don't shoot me down.
Don't shoot me down.
Don't shoot me down.
Don't shoot me down.
Don't shoot me down. Got a wife and kids on Ruby Ridge. Please don't shoot me down. My good dog killed my boy, my only son, my pride and joy. They shot my wife dead on the floor, holding our baby in the cabin door.
Don't shoot me down.
Don't shoot me down.
Don't shoot me down.
Don't shoot me down. Got a wife and kids on Ruby Ridge. Please don't shoot me down.
Don't shoot me down.
Don't shoot me down.
Don't shoot me down.
Don't shoot me down. Got a wife and kids on Ruby Ridge. Please don't shoot me down. And you want to go build a cabin in Idaho, in Idaho. If you're living free, boys don't sell no shotgun, no deputy.
Don't shoot me down.
Don't shoot me down.
Don't shoot me down.
Don't shoot me down.
Got a wife and kids on Ruby Ridge. Please don't shoot me down.
Don't shoot me down.
Don't shoot me down.
Don't shoot me down. Don't shoot me down. Got a wife and kids on Ruby Ridge. Please don't shoot me down.
Kids on Ruby Ridge, please don't shoot me down.
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 Got a wife and kids on Ruby Ridge, please don't shoot me down.
Good evening. This is Truth Quest with Melody. And Professor Eric Karlstrom is my co-host tonight. And that was hymns doing Ruby Ridge on his album Bluegrass Conspiracy. And tonight I've got a very special guest, Eustace Mullins, and Emily, who did Chick's Voices prior to me, did a real good job of just giving a good description of what we were going to be talking about tonight. And so I'll go ahead and mention that Eustace was born in Virginia and was an American political writer, author, and biographer, a friend of the American poet and artist Ezra Pound, and the author of his only authorized biography. He has written a number of books on political and racial subjects, and he was a veteran of the United States Air Force with 38 months of active service during World War II. Are you there, Eric?
Yes, I am.
Okay, we'll get you turned up just a little bit here.
Yeah, and you could turn yourself up, Melody.
Oh, okay. Is that better?
Yes.
Okay, and Eustace, are you there?
Oh, yes.
Okay, great. Well, I'm going to let Eric do the initial talking on this and see where we can take this interesting conversation.
Okay, well, it's certainly a great honor and privilege to have Eustace Mullins as our guest. He's really a tremendous figure, I think, in the 20th century in terms of investigative, you might say investigative reporting. He wrote a book called The Secrets of the Federal Reserve in 1952, and it was the first of many books that have been written about the Federal Reserve, but he did the actual original research on it. And then he's also written a book called The World Order, which, interestingly enough, came out, I think, in 1984 in its first edition, and then 1989 in its second edition. And he's written many, many, many interesting articles. I would encourage everybody who's lucky enough to be listening to turn up the dial and call some friends over and listen very carefully, because there's a lot to be learned from this man. He's done a tremendous amount of research into what I'd call the real history of our country, which is strikingly different from what the mass media tells us. So welcome, Eustace, and you're joining us from Richmond, Virginia. And if I could start out with...
I'm up in the mountain territory of Virginia. It's called Stuart Straff, Virginia.
Okay. Yeah, where I'd like to start, and I you have such a tremendous knowledge of history that we could go in lots of directions, but if we could start back at the initiation of the Federal Reserve back in the early part of the 20th century, that way I think would be a good place to start, and then maybe we could shift over towards World War I and the Bolshevik Revolution and see how perhaps some of the same personages and forces invented communism. So could you tell us a little bit what you discovered in your research on the secrets of the Federal Reserve, Eustace?
Oh, yes, I discovered quite a lot, because I was at the request of the poet Ezra Pound, who was a political prisoner held in St. Elizabeth's Hospital in Washington without trial. I visited him in the hospital, and he requested me to go to the Library of Congress and see what I could find out about the Federal Reserve System. And when I went to the Library of Congress, I found there was no book on the Federal Reserve System. And I began a long period of research, which finally resulted in the book.
And what you discovered was that the Federal Reserve was neither federal, nor did it have any reserves. So who were the people that set this thing up, and for what purpose?
Oh, the people that set this thing up were the richest bankers in the United States, J.P. Morgan and Jacob Schiff and Paul Warburg and their associates. And at that time, I didn't know enough about the Federal Reserve to describe it for what it was. It's called a system, but I finally discovered it's actually a criminal conspiracy. And so I've called it a criminal conspiracy ever since 1953, and I've never heard a word from the Federal Reserve System about complaint about calling it a criminal conspiracy. So I continue to do that, and I'll go on doing that until somebody persuades me not to.
And who benefits really from this kind of system that you're talking about?
Well, it's not actually a system. The Federal Reserve is a central bank, and the principal function of a central bank is to gain control of the right of issue, or the right to print money, which the Act does, and it also provides war finance. Because in Europe, the Rothschilds had been wanting to start a world war since 1885. But their central banks had already bankrupted every country in Europe. And so the only way they could finance a world war was to put a central bank in the United States. And they would have enough money from the American people to finance our world war. This is Woodrow Wilson was elected by the bankers in 1912 to do exactly that, to sign a Federal Reserve Act into law, and that's what he did. The that was financed by the National a city bank in New York City, and that was a Rockefeller bank by John D. Rockefeller. He was the principal stockholder of it. And so the Federal Reserve System was a product of the National City Bank, which was a Rothschild bank.
Okay.
It was directed, the campaign to get a central bank was directed by Baron Albert de Rothschild of London. who wasn't even an American.
Was he using the Bank of England as a model or a prototype for the
Yes,
Reserve?
Because the Bank of England has, since 1695, has been the prototype of the central bank. And the Federal Reserve was set up by Paul Warburg to emulate the Bank of England.
So as I understand it, this Federal Reserve system then allows private individuals to have the monopoly power of printing the money.
Yes.
Basically out of nothing.
I created money out of nothing. That's exactly right. And it has no backing. The United States dollar at the present time is considered by most countries in the world to be entirely worthless because it has no backing of any kind. Neither gold nor silver or commodity dollar or anything else. It just exists as it is. And it's also a monopoly because when the Federal Reserve Act was passed, a provision was included that the stock of the privately owned Federal Reserve Bank could never be sold or bought on any stock exchange in the world. So this set up a monopoly which is endured to the present day. It's never been challenged by anyone.
Yeah, I recall, I've seen you on some videos, Eustace, and in one of the videos you say, you know, if you could print $1 billion, you could be a billionaire. But if you or I do it, it's, of course, it's illegal and we'd get thrown in jail. But these guys have a legal monopoly to create money out of nothing.
Well, they have a legal monopoly because the government has issued these private stockholders a government license to print money. And that is entirely due to the license of the federal government, which has no stock and has never had any stock in the Federal Reserve System. So, in effect, it's a giveaway, because if the Federal Reserve System is going to print the government's money, the government should properly own the stock in it. It's never had a single share of Federal Reserve stock.
There's an excellent video I'm sure you've seen called The Money Masters, which I learned a lot by watching that maybe 10 times or more. But it talks about the fact that this right to print the money went back and forth between actually the federal government and privately held banks seven or eight times in the history of this country.
Oh, yes. It was sort of in a period of transition. And finally, the Federal Reserve Act of 1913 solidified that control through the Federal Reserve Board of Governors.
How did that come about? How did that come about and get set up, Eustace?
I described that as having come about through a criminal conspiracy of a number of private bankers conspired to obtain this monopoly, and then they went down to Washington and personally lobbied it through Congress. Paul Warburg and Jacob Schiff and a number of other bankers actually paraded through the halls of Congress and lobbied for the bank until it was approved by Congress.
Okay, and it was at where they had that meeting at this was set up and on Jekyll Island. Is that how these bankers got together and got this initiated?
Well, there was considerable opposition to the bank, and that was led by Congressman Charles Augustus Lindbergh Sr. of Minnesota. He led a group of congressmen from the Midwestern states and the far western states, because the eastern seaboard states were behind the Federal Reserve monopoly.
Mm-hmm.
But the rest of the United States was pretty well left out. And the people in the Midwestern and western states were almost 100% opposed to it.
And yet they were able to still get this through?
Pardon?
And yet they were still able to get this legislation through, or set up this bank.
Oh, yes, they got the Federal Reserve Act through Congress.
Okay.
Eustace, if we could go back to what you said earlier. You said in 1885 the Rothschilds decided they wanted a world war, and that's why they had to set up the Federal Reserve in the United States, because they could do that.
Behind the scenes of the First World War were, first of all, the munitions makers, which were all over Europe, and then secondly, it was the bankers themselves who were going to finance the world war and make the profit from it. Because the World War would create debt on which they could collect interest. And Ezra Pound investigated the origins of the causes of the First World War, and he came to the conclusion that the bankers created the First World War simply to create debt on which they could draw interest.
Yeah. War, I guess, the Rothschilds are famous, these international bankers from Europe are famous for having discovered that the best way to make money is to loan money to governments, especially governments that are in war, because
the
governments will pay any amount of money at high interest rates to win that war. And so this is how they made their fortune. They loaned money to all sides of wars. In fact, they even went so far as to help instigate the wars, because war is the greatest money maker. Is that correct?
Oh, yes, because it takes a lot of trouble to create a war, to get several countries to battle each other and have a lot of their people killed, and an enormous debt is created by the war. So it's a big undertaking for any government to be led into a war by the Rothschilds.
Yeah. Now, if we could switch over to the Bolshevik Revolution, because we're talking about the same time period. 1913, the Federal Reserve is passed. That year or the next year, the 14th Amendment is passed, which allows the government to collect income tax from the citizens, which then guarantees that these debts are going to be paid to the international bankers. And then very shortly thereafter, war breaks out in Europe, and a big portion of that is the Bolshevik Revolution that happens in Russia. Now, you've written a piece called The Secret Holocaust, talking about what happens in Russia. And I think this is a story that most Americans don't know much about. So could you fill us in?
Well, they haven't been told. They haven't been allowed to find out the truth of that. You see, the main instigator of the Jekyll Island Conference, at which the Federal Reserve Bank was created, was financed by John D. Rockefeller. See, Rockefeller had already established a world monopoly in oil, and with the profits from that, he made a very good investment in the Federal Reserve conspiracy and took over our entire system of money and credit.
Yeah, and then who are the people that set up the Bolshevik Revolution, and for what purpose?
Well, the Bolshevik Revolution was actually instigated by the British Secret Service, which is the Secret Service of the Bank of England. So you can really say that the Bolshevik Revolution was created by the Bank of England. And the reason for this was that the Tsar of Russia was at that time the richest man in the world, and his cousin, King George V of England, was very jealous of the Tsar of Russia. So that was a motivation in perpetrating the Bolshevik Revolution in Russia.
So they used the war as to fleece each other? Eustace? They kind of use that war to fleece each other in the nobility areas?
Pardon?
They use the war to fleece each other in the nobility areas.
The war that decimated the nobility?
Mm-hmm. No, they take their money from each other. I guess that's okay. I don't think you're following me, so.
Well, I'm trying to get you to get into some of the stuff that you talk about in your article, The Secret Holocaust, and I'll summarize it a little bit. About 66 million Russians were killed under the imposition of the communist, first the Bolshevik Revolution, and then, of course, the communists. And 66 million people were killed in a Holocaust that was not well publicized. In fact, for some reason, the American press did not talk about it. The American press was somehow very sympathetic to the cause of the Bolsheviks in many cases. And it wasn't until Alexander Solzhenitsyn's book came out, The Gulag Archipelago and others, that the true dimensions of the horror that occurred in Russia under communism have started to emerge. So if I could get you to talk a little bit about the philosophy of communism and where it came from and who benefited from the takeover of Tsarist Russia.
Well, the philosophy of communism was a resolve to overthrow all of the ruling classes in every country in the world. Another, they wanted a worldwide communist revolution. That was a goal, and they pretty well achieved it. But at first, they murdered the Tsar of Russia and all his family. And at the outset of all this was that the only ruling family left in Europe was the English royal family. They were the only survivors, and they are the ones who had created the Bolshevik Revolution in the first place.
Okay. So certainly destroying monarchies across Europe was one of the goals of World War One, from the point of view of the people who benefited from it, who orchestrated it, and who profited from it. They wanted to destroy monarchies in Europe. For what reason?
Well, Karl Marx, the father of communism, invented the concept of class warfare. And he claimed that every country was oppressed by the fact that you had a ruling class which perpetrated practical slavery over all the people in that country. And by killing off the ruling class, you could free the people of the world from this oppression.
This is the line of Karl Marx. Was this his true goal? Or was there a different goal?
Well, there was a hidden goal. The Freemason philosophy of the Freemason fraternity actually was the secret agent behind the communist revolution. It was a Freemason revolution.
In that sense, you say it's a Freemason revolution. In that sense, it's similar to the French Revolution and perhaps even the
American
Revolution.
Yes, because the Freemasons were worldwide, and they perpetrated, the Rothschilds perpetrated the French Revolution, which is essentially a revolt against the Catholic faith in France. They killed most of the priests and the nuns in France, and thereby hoped to end the Catholic Church in France.
Okay, so there is this secret society, the Freemasons would be a secret society, that is dedicated to taking down monarchy and taking down the Catholic Church in particular, Christian Church in general.
Yes. And a number of Catholic popes have denounced the Freemasons for this very conspiracy. It was well known to the popes in Rome.
What do the Freemasons want to take over the world for? Why would they be behind this so-called worldwide revolutionary conspiracy?
Well, they seek worldwide revolution because they seek to destroy and break down all governments in every country so that they can rule the world.
And when you say they can rule the world, are we talking about a fairly tiny elite? Are we talking about a financial elite? Are we talking about a religious elite? What are we talking about? I can sense you're a little reluctant to go where I know you can go, but I'll let you just take it wherever you want it.
Oh, well, the Freemasonry originated in ancient Babylon, where at the present time we're bogged down in a feudal war with no outcome. And so we're right back where we were 6,000 years ago.
Freemasonry originates in Babylon.
Yeah, through Nimrod, who was the first dictator of the world. The ruler of Babylon was known as a dictator. And so Freemasonry has persisted since Nimrod's time.
So would you say that the Freemasons, then, their goal is to establish this world order, new world order, sometimes it's called, which is basically a one-world government or a dictatorship of
the world? Yes, well, they call it a world order. It's actually the consortium of Rothschild private banks, central banks, which has set up throughout the world. And this consortium of central banks, by cooperating throughout the world, effectively rules the world through their operations.
So would you say that they have achieved their goal at this point, or that they are still working towards this goal?
Oh, they're still working toward it, because in every country in which there's a central bank, there arises a great deal of opposition. And there is some opposition in the United States, but it's very disorganized and not able to present a comprehensive picture of the situation that we're in.
Yeah. And of course, one way that they control public opinion, of course, is through the press.
The press and the government are practically synonymous in this country because they work together.
Essentially for these financial forces, would you say that?
Oh, yeah.
Okay. You are from the South, and you have actually mentioned that the Civil War might have been fomented by the same Rothschild banking interests.
Rothschild financed the abolitionist movement, which was reputed to try to free the slaves in the southern states. But actually, it was a revolutionary movement which was instituted by a Freemason society in this country called the Knights of the Golden Circle. And they precipitated the Civil War for the Rothschilds.
And the goal of the Rothschilds would have been basically to destroy this country, is that correct?
Oh, yes.
Yeah. And to of course, get their central bank established. Yeah. What other wars would you say have been fomented by the same international financial interests in league with various secret societies?
Well, my mentor was the poet Ezra Pound, who was locked up in St. Louis Hospital in Washington, D.C., and I met Ezra Pound there in 1948, and he started me on the study of the Federal Reserve System and the history of the Rothschilds, and I've been in that study ever since.
Would you say that these same financial interests have created, say, World War II, the Vietnam War, the Korean War, this present war on terror, any other particular wars?
Oh, yes.
Are these all basically following the same dynamic?
Oh, there's always the same pattern. And the these continuous wars have been financed through the Rothschild central banks, and they all have the same origins.
Okay.
So these wars are not about nationalism or national interests or ideology. They're simply the personal goals of these bankers of the Rothschild banks.
So when the young man is recruited and told that he has an opportunity to serve his country and defend his family and be a hero and that sort of thing, you think he's more or less being fooled. Is that correct?
Oh, yes. Well, I remember when I was inducted into the armed services in World War II, we had to swear an oath to defend the Constitution. We were not asked to defend the United States, but we were just asked to defend the Constitution, because the Constitution was the document which established the central banks.
Mm-hmm.
Of course, that wasn't explained to us at that time. I didn't find it out until some years later.
How do you explain that? That makes me curious here. That's the first I'd ever heard of that.
Oh, how to explain that?
Yes.
Yeah, how does the Constitution establish the central banks?
Well, you see, the Constitution, Article 1, Section 10, entrusted the creation of the nation's money to the Congress of the United States.
Mm-hmm.
So these private bankers came to Washington and bribed or intimidated enough congressmen to pass the Federal Reserve Act, and by doing so, they delegated this congressional power to a privately owned bank.
I see. So it was the 1-2 punch.
Oh, yes.
First you, yeah, yeah.
And
well,
it changed
very,
the subject.
Go ahead.
Well, they achieved this goal by fraud, because they promised the Congress that if they would pass the Federal Reserve Act in 1913, that the stockholders of the Federal Reserve Bank would pay all of their profits into the United States Treasury, which had never paid one penny.
Mm.
So if you set up the country then with that in mind, then does that have anything to do with what took place with Hamilton and them over earlier on in the prior century? Anybody following me? Yeah, had his duel with Aaron Burr. Wasn't that over the federal setting up the banking system then? And then I'm trying to think of the other president, Jackson. Didn't they have?
I didn't quite get the question.
Okay. Well, I guess what I'm trying to say here is, if the Constitution was what was set up with it in mind that they were going to have the Federal Reserve come in later, and these bankers were going to take over the operation of the United States government through this Federal Reserve, then my understanding is that that wasn't the first time that
the framers of the United States Constitution made no provision for a Federal Reserve Act. They never conceived of one.
Okay.
And it was these private bankers who came to Washington and lobbied the Federal Reserve Act through Congress to give private bankers the constitutional privilege of issuing the money of the United States.
Okay. All right.
It was done through fraud.
Okay.
Yeah, I think what you're talking about, Melody, is that Alexander Hamilton was a representative of the Bank of England, and this was his goal earlier on, and of course,
oh, yes.
Jackson
well,
was the guy who killed the bank. So these are figures that figure prominently in this issue, but in earlier times.
Right, and that was what I was trying
to... Well, Alexander Hamilton is generally conceded to be the originator of the U.S. Treasury. But the Federal Reserve Act of 1913 removed the United States Treasury as the sole fiscal agent of the United States and turned it over to the Federal Reserve Bank. So the United States Treasury essentially has not existed since 1913. Although the Bureau of Internal Revenue issues tax statements to American citizens with the heading from the Department of the U.S. Treasury. And the U.S. Treasury has existed since 1913.
So this is a fraud.
Oh, it's a total fraud because a Bureau of Internal Revenue Service is actually a private collection agency for a private-owned bank. In other words, you're not doing any business with the Federal Reserve Bank, and yet the Federal Reserve Bank can tax you. And that has never been explained to anyone's satisfaction.
Right. And the money that we spend every year, and of course tax time is coming up here, where does this go? Does this go to these
By law, by the Federal Reserve Act of 1913, it must be deposited in a Federal Reserve Bank. The United States government never sees a penny of that money. And it must be deposited in a Federal Reserve Bank, usually by truck, by nightfall of the same day. It cannot be allowed to be in any other type of bank except for the Federal Reserve Bank overnight. So the Bureau of Internal Revenue Service is collecting tax assistance, assessments from the American people and depositing it in this private bank. And the government never sees one penny of that money.
And we don't really know who the shareholders of this bank are to this day, but we suspect that many of them are European bankers. Is that correct?
Oh, yes. And most of the American stockholders of Federal Reserve stock have deposited their stock in tax-exempt foundations like the Rockefellers, and they pay no interest on the money and the income from that stock.
Right.
But if you own any stock of any kind, you have to report the amount of stock that you owe and the value to the Internal Revenue Service, and they then tax you on the value of that stock. But Federal Reserve stock is exempt from taxation.
Would you hazard a guess as to what percentage of our tax money goes directly to the Rothschild family in Europe?
Well, presumably by the Rothschilds being the principal stockholders of the Federal Reserve Bank, most of it goes to the Rothschild Bank.
So when we're paying our taxes this year, we can just write a little note at the bottom saying, please enjoy your yacht and your mansion, Mr. Rothschild or whatever, because that's who's going to get it, huh?
Oh, that's who's going to get it. And no one even claims that the United States, it used to be that the Internal Revenue Service claimed that they were collecting taxes from the American people in order to finance the obligations of the government. But they no longer make any such claim because the money goes directly to the private stockholders of the Federal Reserve Bank.
Right. Well, I think we're starting to get the picture of why you titled your book The World Order, A Study of the Hegemony of Parasitism. Could you, we've actually been talking around that, but it's a fascinating title, The Hegemony of Parasitism. Could you explain that a little bit?
Well, this is what it is. The Federal Reserve Bank is the office which collects the money for the parasites. In other words, the parasite is feeding on every American citizen.
So you're looking at kind of a biological metaphor. We have a host organism.
Well, it's a biological operation. Parasitism is a biological phenomenon.
Right. So we have a relatively small number of people who are, by virtue of their position in the financial world, reaping tremendous profits off of the work and the efforts and the sweat and the labor of,
yes,
of the host organism.
Yeah. That's right. This parasitism goes back to the old Babylonian city in which this system originated, which was essentially an extortion system by which the powerful lords of the city exacted tribute from everyone who lived there. And that's essentially the Federal Reserve system that we have today.
Well, you say extortion. Where's the muscle in this extortion system? I suppose it's the military, correct?
Well, theoretically it's the military, but in actual operation, it's simply the Federal Bureau of Investigation and the Bureau of Internal Revenue.
Okay.
And the Federal Reserve System itself does no collection of money from the American people. It's all done through a private collection agency.
Yeah, it's a sweet deal if you happen to be sitting with stock like the Rockefellers or the Rothschilds. Yeah. Okay, you've written a couple of some very interesting articles. I would encourage our listeners to go on to the Internet, maybe go to Google and Google Eustace Mullins and see what kind of articles you come up with. I downloaded a bunch of them over the past several months. One of them is called The War Against Christianity, and then you have another one called The Four Horsemen of the Apocalypse. Could you explain the premise of these articles?
Well, yes. The articles are intended to inform the people about the nature of the forces that they're fighting. And by examining and making public the real origin of these sources, we may be able to oppose them in some way.
There does seem to be a concerted effort to take down the Christian Church, and you make the case in your article, The Four Horsemen of the Apocalypse, that and those horsemen, by the way, are people like Jerry Falwell, Pat Robertson, Billy Graham, and this Billy Ray Hargis.
These are the very people who got the United States to set up the State of Israel, and in the Middle East, and now the State of Israel is extorting money from every country in the world, because through people like Falwell and Pat Robertson, they have proclaimed that the State of Israel is now the kingdom of God, and that if you don't support Israel, you're fighting God. And of course they offer no basis for any of these observations. In fact, there's nothing published by the State of Israel that justifies the collection of money from the people of the United States, although they get $19 billion a year from the United States government.
$19 billion, is that what you said?
Yeah, that's combined military and financial aid.
Yeah, I've read different figures. I've read $3 billion, $6 billion. I've also read that since 1948, when Israel was established, the U.S. government has paid out somewhere in the neighborhood of $1.6 trillion.
That sounds very logical.
Yeah,
pretty much in line with what's been going on. The American people had no concept of the amount of money we have poured into the so-called kingdom of God in Israel. And anyone who criticizes Israel in any way is called he's fighting God.
Called an anti-Semite.
Yeah, well, anti-Semite is a technical term for it, but it's actually a person who opposes the work of God and criticizing anything that Israel does.
So by having these fundamentalist Christians like Falwell and Robertson and Billy Graham as apologists for the state of Israel, this is a pretty slick propaganda ploy, because then the people of the United States are going to be more kindly disposed towards dishing out all this this money. It's very interesting, maybe you've been following our presidential race now, and I remember just a few days ago the big question was, where does Barack Obama stand on the question of Israel? And it the way the whole story was covered, it sounded like, boy, he really better say the right thing or else he's toast. Would you agree with that?
Oh, yes. And Barack Obama is actually guided by Zbigniew Brzezinski, who has replaced Henry Kissinger as the leading advocate of the State of Israel in the United States.
Yeah, well, it's very clear that Barack Obama, this very, very young, inexperienced senator, has some powerful backers. Otherwise, there's no way you could explain his meteoric rise into the center stage.
Oh, yes, he came from nowhere. He was a poor boy from Indonesia, and suddenly he becomes a national figure. You can't do that unless you have a very large and expensive propaganda machine to sell him to the American people.
Zbigniew Brzezinski also wrote The Grand Chessboard and was one of the initiators of the Trilateral Commission, correct?
Oh, yes, Brzezinski. Brzezinski has been a very important figure behind the scenes, although he's entirely unknown to the American public.
I've got a couple quotes here that I think are pretty interesting. Here's this from Democratic Senator William Fulbright on CBS TV in April 15, 1972. The United States Senate is subservient to Israel. Israel controls the Senate. This has been demonstrated time and again, and this has made it difficult for the government. Then another interesting quote, this is coming from Israeli Prime Minister Ariel Sharon on October 3, 2001, as reported on the Kol Yisrael radio. He says, every time we do something, you tell me America will do this and will do that. I want to tell you something very clear. Don't worry about American pressure on Israel. We, the Jewish people, control America, and the Americans know it. This is coming from the Prime Minister of Israel, Ariel Sharon, in 2001, shortly after September 11th.
Yeah, well, he was considered the voice of authority in Israel, and when he made that statement, it never reached the American people, and they have no idea of it to this day.
Right. Yeah, you have to really dig to get these alternative perspectives, because the control of the media by the financial powers that be is so overwhelming. And just again for our listeners, Eustace Mullins has done an enormous amount of research, and if you read his books, he names the names, he gives the dates. He's not just giving generalities. In fact, he gives you so much information that sometimes it can be kind of overwhelming. But if you can go through it, you get the sense of what this world order is, who's benefiting, and the methods that are being used, and the ultimate end game goal of this worldwide revolutionary conspiracy, as it's sometimes called, also called the New World Order, also called the Plan, also called the Secret Government, also called the International Conspiracy, etc. But we are talking about secret societies, we're talking about international bankers, we're talking about control of the press, we're talking about control of the politicians through money, and we're talking about control of education. Would you mention something about the education?
The education system?
Yeah, how education is controlled by the same world order.
Oh, yes, the world order sent two men to Moscow in 1924, to study the communist system. And these two men were George Constant and John Dewey. And they studied under the communist government for 2 years and then returned to the United States and set up the National Education Association. And the National Education Association program since 1924 has been the program of the Communist Party. And no one has ever denied that. And no one has ever been asked about it, so they haven't had to deny it.
The National Education Association program is the same as that of the Communist Party.
Well, yes. It's the education of American children is entirely based on Pavlov conditioning, the conditioned reflex. And our school children are taught to answer in a certain way when they ask anything. That's called the conditioned reflex. And that is the total operation of the American educational system.
In a way, this you would have to call this mind control. Would you call this thought control or mind control?
Oh, yes, a mind control and conditioned reflex are the same thing.
Yeah.
In other words, you train people the way you train dogs to respond in a certain way.
So this would fit in perhaps with the ultimate goal of the world order, which is the basic enslavement of the vast majority of humanity to serve the
Universal slavery is the goal.
The goal is universal slavery, but these parasites then would live pretty high on the hog, and we would all serve them. Is that
the point? They live very well. They're what they call the international set. They travel around the world, and they enjoy the best of everything, and they have plenty of money to do whatever they want to do. And they never work, of course.
Yes, yeah. Well, I've been teaching since, I started teaching university in 1981, and I can tell you that it's getting harder. Our students are coming to us with less well prepared, they're less able, their skills are less well developed, their ability to think critically is less well developed. And it would appear that this, in fact, is just what the world order intends. Is that correct?
Yeah, that's correct.
We don't want critical thinkers. We don't want people who can read lots of books and figure things out.
You don't want any thinkers, period. You don't want people to think about anything. And you can see that in the American school system under the John Dewey method, because the children are never taught to think about anything. They're only trained in making a conditioned response to any kind of order that they get.
Well, you know, I do, they haven't succeeded in dumbing us all down. I think there's quite a few young people who I know who are quite smart and can think critically. So, but there's always this attempt to make the masses more docile, more controlled. But it doesn't ever seem to succeed so far. Would you agree with that?
Well, that's done by not only by the schools, but by government, and by you even find that particular program is also used by many businesses and corporations that employ the majority of United States workers. They're actually trained in their job to follow orders and do as they're told.
Yeah.
That's the conditioned reflex.
Yeah. The stories that I read in different articles also are that back in the mid-1800s, there were a few Americans like, Daniel Coit Gilman and various others who went over and studied in Bavaria and studied the Prussian school system, which was also dedicated to the prospect that only a tiny minority, 0.1%, would actually do the thinking and the controlling of the society, and that the vast majority of the masses, 95%, 90%, would simply be the worker class, and therefore they'd go to the full school.
Well, Gilman and those people are part of what was an ongoing conspiracy, which is known as Skull and Bones, which is a European Freemason society, which was organized around the world, and they ruled through indirection. See, the Bush family was trained through Skull and Bones. And in the last public presidential election, we had two Skull and Bones members, John Kerry and George Bush, competing against each other. So whichever one won, you would get a Skull and Bones man as the President of the United States.
What a rigged system, huh? And it becomes
it's a
even
system.
More alarming. Yeah.
Well, they try to foresee everything and provide for it in advance.
And, of course, Anthony C. Sutton has written a book called America's Secret Establishment, An Introduction to the Order of Skull and Bones, in which he says basically this is a American chapter of this German satanic secret society called the Illuminati or the Order of Death.
Yes, Skull and Bones is an Illuminati society. Yes, I knew Anthony Sutton very well. I lectured with him for years.
Pardon me?
I used to travel with Anthony Sutton quite a bit to audiences, mostly in California, and
yeah,
we lectured there.
He must have learned a lot from you because he wrote a book called The Federal Reserve Conspiracy as well.
Oh, yes.
In which he basically retells the story that you put together. Isn't that right? One of the many books.
Oh, that's correct, because that is the actual conspiracy which runs the world at the present time.
So this is not just an old story. This is an old story and a current new story in the sense that if you understand the Federal Reserve conspiracy, as Sutton put it, or the secrets of the Federal Reserve, as you put it, you understand the way the world works.
Oh, yes. That's the way it operates.
Yeah. There's a new book called Ellen. It's called The Web of Debt, The Shocking Truth About Our Money System, The Sleight of Hand That Has Trapped Us in Debt and How We Can Break Free, by Ellen Hodgson Brown. It's quite a fat book, but I think what it does is basically retells the story and then gives some suggestions as to how we might be able to break free. Have you also written on that subject, Eustace? How can we break the hold of this parasite, the Federal Reserve?
Well, I have a book called The Biological Parasite, which lays out, according to the laws of nature, the operation of the whole system.
And how would you use the laws of nature to our own advantage in this case?
Well, the laws of nature govern the operation of the biological parasite. It operates according to natural laws. But it has no particular philosophy. It simply obeys the laws of nature that it lives as a parasite.
So you say starve the parasite.
Yeah.
Starve the parasite, but how do you starve the parasite? You'd have to rewrite the laws. You'd have to you'd have to redesign the money system at its root. Have you made any proposals about that?
No, I'm not working on anything like that at the present time.
I know other people have and are trying to do that sort of thing.
Oh, they're trying to because they see that needs to be done. And they're working on it from that point of view.
Right. What other secret societies, Eustace, would you say have been involved in this kind of parasitic organism? With this long-term goal of enslaving humanity, destroying national sovereignties, setting up a one-world government, you might call it a feudalistic system, that you've mentioned the Freemasons, you've mentioned Skull and Bones.
Well, I take that up in my book, The Curse of Canaan, which is the history of demons in the Western world. And it goes into the various manifestations that appeared throughout history, since Babylon.
The curse of Canaan. And what are some of these other secret societies?
Well, they're all described in the curse of Canaan. And they're pretty well covered in that book.
Yeah, well, since right now people are just listening to us, well, if I throw some out, will you tell me if I'm thinking along the same lines? Are you talking about the Council on Foreign Relations and the Bilderberger Group and the Trilateral Commission and these kinds of the Round Table and the Knights of the Garter and things like that?
All those organizations are well known, and Quigley covered a lot of those in his book. Carl Quigley,
Tragedy and Hope.
He was the instructor of Bill Clinton, you know, when he was president. Before he was president.
And that was in the book Tragedy and Hope.
Yeah.
Okay. Let me get to a break here, and this is KHENLP, 106.9 Salida. It's 41 degrees out, and this is Truth Quest with Professor Carlstrom and Melody, and we've got as a special guest Eustace Mullins, and I was kind of hoping that you could get in a little bit on the fact of how, didn't you do a lot of work in the Library of Congress, Eustace? Did he hear me?
No, I can't hear anything.
Okay, did you do a lot of work with the Library of Congress?
Oh, yes. All of my books were researched in the Library of Congress.
Okay.
I was an employee there, but I was fired in 1952 by Senator Herbert Lehman, the national chairman of the Anti-Defamation League, B'nai B'rith.
Anti-Defamation League, B'nai B'rith, of course, is a powerful Jewish lobby in this country.
Well, it's a terrorist organization. When I was fired by the Library of Congress, it was through the work of a terrorist organization.
As I understand, your book, The Secrets of the Federal Reserve, was every copy was burned on the orders of the German government. Wasn't that true?
Oh, yes, that's true. Say, James Conant was the American ambassador to Germany at that time, and his assistant was Benjamin Buttonweiser. And Benjamin Buttonweiser was a partner of Kuhn Loeb Company, the Rothschild firm in New York. And they burned the entire edition and bankrupted the man who had spent all that money paying for the printing.
So I suppose you must have had some lean times in your life when these books are being burned and banned.
Oh, it's been a nightmare all the way through because these people never quit. You know, they work 24 hours a day.
So you have experienced a lot of personal hardship and harassment, I guess, because of the writings that you've done. Is that correct?
Well, yes. The state of Virginia, in which I was born and live at the present time, the state of Virginia was a key conspirator in the passage of the Federal Reserve Act of 1913 because Woodrow Wilson, a Virginian, was president, and Carter Glass of Lynchburg, Virginia, was the senator who got the act through Congress. And after I published my book on the Federal Reserve System, every state agency of the state of Virginia harassed me personally, and they even I wouldn't renew my driving permit because they put fake medical records in my driving record that I was in the last stages of dementia. These were fake records came from the University of Virginia in Charlottesville, Virginia. And there was no basis to the monster, but they claimed I was in the last stages of Alzheimer's and also in the last stages of dementia, and that I had had a total loss of memory. So therefore, I couldn't be allowed to drive a car. And my driving permit was taken away from me, and I haven't had a driving permit for 20 years. And the hardship wrought on me was such that since I had to walk everywhere, I suffered a complete physical collapse, and I'm now a cripple in a wheelchair.
Wow. Well, it takes a lot of courage to stand up like you have done. Part of the motivation that you have, as I understand it, Eustace, is that you are a Christian, and you do believe in the values of Christianity, and you do believe in the values of Christian civilization, which you think are very much threatened by this this worldwide revolutionary conspiracy. So what you're doing is really, it's not only an intellectual challenge, it's also a spiritual
mission. Oh, yes, really. One of my books is My Life in Christ, which I published in 1968, and which is now out of print. But that book explains my commitment to this work through my belief in Christ.
And the truth shall set us free if we can learn the truth. Well, that's what Jesus said, I guess, huh?
Oh, yes, but we have to learn the truth. It's just handed to us.
Yeah, yeah. Well, to shift a little bit back to some of the big picture things, you have an article called The Cold War... was a $5 trillion
hoax. $5 trillion hoax.
Yeah.
Well, that was an extra $5 trillion, which was stolen from the American people to help this world order.
How did they do that, Eustace?
It would this be for defense expenditures mainly, or what?
Eustace? Are you still?
I think we've lost him. Are you there, Eustace?
Yes, I'm here, but I'm not hearing your question.
Okay, here's the question again. The $5 trillion that we lost during that period, roughly 1945 to 1989, would this be mostly in defense expenditures for the military-industrial complex?
Well, that was military-industrial spending during that period. That's a matter of record.
Yeah. So this would be mostly military spending. And it was a hoax because why? Because the same groups were controlling both the Soviet Union and the United States?
Well, the Cold War was a hoax because... It was a Cold War. It was never a war. And the United States was never attacked during that time. So we had to go to Asia and fight in Vietnam and Korea because the communists wouldn't come over here and fight. We had to travel to Asia to fight communism. But they never attacked the United States. But still, we spent $5 trillion on this non-existent war.
$5 trillion to what? To
fight a non-existent war that never was the Cold War.
Well, Noam Chomsky would say that the Cold War gave the United States military and government kind of the carte blanche control of the federal purse strings for the military-industrial complex, and it gave them permission to control.
Well, it was a blank check. Because the Cold War never existed.
But there was so much fear stirred up.
Well, that fear was deliberately engendered in the American people. You see, after they had bombed Japan, that was done deliberately to create a climate of fear so that they could intimidate the rest of the world because they would be destroyed by nuclear bombs. And, of course, the propaganda in this country was... that we were going to be nuclear bombed by Russia, and we would be totally extinct. And, of course, Russia only had the atom bomb because they obtained it from the United States.
Yeah. Yeah, Anthony C. Seddon writes about that in a couple books about how it's...
Oh, it was well known at the time that the Russians never developed an atom bomb. They sent the plans to Moscow from the United States.
Right. Right. In fact, the Soviet Union could never have made it at all as a country under communism if it were not supported by this group of international financiers.
Well, we spent $1 billion to develop the atomic bomb, and Russia, of course, did not have $1 billion, so they had to use our bomb.
Yeah, so we just gave them the secrets.
Yes, it was passed to them, and the Rosenbergs, a Jewish couple, were the ones who actually passed the bomb to Russia.
Right. So this is a very effective way of maintaining kind of control over the American population through fear of a great enemy. And then fear of a great enemy then becomes the way that the government can maintain its control. Is that correct?
Oh, yes. Well, you see, the American people and the American nation has never had an enemy since 1945, when we were the most powerful nation in the world. And so the only enemy we have had since 1945 is the State of Israel, which constantly promotes dissension in the United States in order to maintain control over the American people.
So you'd say right now the Israeli dog is kind of in control of the Israeli tail is wagging the American dog. Is that what?
Oh yes, we're being wagged by the State of Israel.
Yeah. And what do you think they have in mind for us? What is their goal? Since they have this control through their many, many powerful lobbies and through media, through Hollywood, through the press, through certainly through the banks, through the debt system, what is their goal for us?
Well, the goal is of the State of Israel is the continued exploitation of the American people. And that's why we send the billions of dollars to the State of Israel, and we help Israel fight every Arab nation in the Middle East by furnishing all of their munitions. See, every Arab that is killed by a bullet from the United States. The Israelis have never bought a bullet in their life. It's all right. Coming from Washington.
And where does Britain, England, figure into this?
Well, Britain figures into this by, since we supposedly won the American Revolution, we've just been, Britain has maintained its power over us as a colony of England. And so everything we do is as a colony of Israel and a colony of the United States. I mean, a colony of Great Britain.
Yeah. I've got an article about British Israel, that somehow these two forces have merged.
Oh, yes. They've been merged for some time. British Israel is a very powerful force in the world today.
And those two, would you say British Israel then is kind of the ascendant force, that it's the more powerful force even than the United States? Or that
because it's worldwide. And British Israel is sort of a religion in itself, but it's a religion which worships England and Israel, but exploits the people of the United States.
Yeah, there are some very interesting documents that go back to Cecil Rhodes, who was another agent of the Rothschilds around the early 1900s, late 1800s, who set up the Rhodes Scholarship. And in one of his wills, he makes the statement about the importance of bringing back the United States as a colony in the British Empire, and the recovery of the of North America as a British colony. I think this is something
that is a purpose, and they're working night and day to achieve that.
So we Americans may feel that we emancipated ourselves in the American Revolution, that we are free, we have a constitution, but the British and the Israeli forces, we could call them British Israel, they don't view it that way. They view us as their colony, as a people and a territory to be exploited and profited from. Is that correct?
Well, it was apparent at the end of the American Revolution that America didn't win that revolution because all mortgages and loans owed to England were collected from the American people. But because our judiciary was Freemasonic and completely in the pay of England.
Well, isn't that what the Bar Association is? Is the British Aristocratic Registry?
I think he's having a hard time hearing you.
I know. What I was saying is, isn't the Bar Association the British Aristocratic Registry?
Oh, that comes right out of London.
Okay.
Yeah, the American Bar Association has been denounced by a number of historians as an agent of England.
Well, I get very confused, I have to say, when I think about who these puppeteers are. I know that there is a strong English influence or British influence. I know there's a strong influence of Israel. I know there's a strong influence of the international financial community, which is does have its headquarters in the city of London. So I guess we're talking about kind of a financial hierarchy, which is centered in both of those places. Is that right? Or is something else centered in Israel? What is centered in Israel? If you have the city of London in England, that's
well,
the
city of London and the Bank of England and the British Secret Service are all centered in London.
Yeah, MI6, MI5. Okay, yeah. Those are very powerful global players.
They originated as CIA. Our Central Intelligence Agency was formulated in 1944 in London by the British Secret Service.
Yeah.
It's been the agency British Secret Service ever since.
Would it be fair to say that the CIA and the MI5 and MI6 and the Mossad work together?
Oh, well, I've maintained for a number of years that all of the national intelligence agencies work as together for a common goal. And so you had these movies about the James Bond and so forth, which portrayed the intelligence agencies of the various governments as fighting and murdering each other all the time. And that never happened because they were working together.
So they were always part of this worldwide revolutionary conspiracy.
Oh, yes, they certainly were. And they were responsible to the central control. Well, in fact, England sent one of its principal intelligence agencies to Moscow as head of the Soviet Secret Service.
Right, right. And I've recently been reading that James Angleton, one of the top CIA guys in the early days of the CIA, was very, very, very interconnected with the Mossad, which is the Israeli intelligence.
Oh, they were. You know, Mossad never had to furnish its own budget. Most of its budget was furnished from Washington by the Central Intelligence Agency. So they had an unlimited amount of money to spend on their intelligence work.
This is an amazing amazing friendship, then, the United States government and the Israeli government.
It's not really a friendship. It's just that we have become a colony of Israel. And we work as a colony of the state of Israel.
We're more the colony, they're more the empire.
Oh, yes. They were They're the overlords, and they issue the orders. In fact, the ambassador from Israel in Washington is the most powerful ambassador in Washington.
I suppose the reason it's counterintuitive that a small country like Israel would be issuing orders to the United States, since the United States has this incredibly powerful military. We are supposedly the only superpower. So what power do they have that trumps the superpower of the American military?
The power of Israel is an international power which operates in every country in the world. You cannot go into any country in the world today that you don't have an Israeli presence there. And Mossad agents infiltrate the country and overthrow the government. See, they overthrow
CIA
the
CIA is also,
it was Mossad which infiltrated Persia and overthrew the Shah of Persia. And he was a very powerful monarch, but the Mossad had no time, no trouble in fomenting a revolution, and the Shah was forced to leave Persia.
Yeah.
And he died as a refugee.
Well, didn't the CIA have something to do with that, too?
Oh, yes. The CIA, CIA had Kermit Roosevelt, one of its leading agents was in Persia and engineered the entire overthrow of the Shah of Persia.
Yeah, I think took out Mossadegh, who was democratically elected in 1953 or something like that, and then installed the Shah of Iran, and he was then the puppet of, I suppose he was the United States' puppet, but he might have been Israel's puppet as well, huh?
He probably was both.
Yeah, probably both. Well, I have an interesting quote here from Benjamin Disraeli, who was a prime minister in England. He was the first Jewish prime minister in England. And this is in his book, Coningsby. It said, I had on my arrival at St. Petersburg an interview with the Russian minister of finance, Count Kanarin. I beheld the son of a Lithuanian Jew. I had an audience on my arrival at Madrid with the Spanish minister. I beheld one like myself, the son of a Nuevo Cristiano, a Jew of Aragon. In consequence of what transpired at Madrid, I went straight to consult the president of the French Council. I beheld the son of a French Jew. We fixed on Prussia. Count Armin entered the cabinet, and I beheld a Prussian Jew. So, you see, my dear Coningsby, that the world is governed by very different personages to what is imagined by those who are not behind the scenes. This would be somewhere in the late 1800s, I think. Is that right? So perhaps this lock on financial power has translated itself into an international power over time.
Well, it definitely has.
And,
There's a couple of things that you, articles or books that you wrote. One was The Secret History of the Atom Bomb. And the other one was The Murder by Injection by the Great The Great Swine Flu Massacre. Can you elaborate on those at all, Eustace? Those writings? Can you hear me? I don't think he can again.
I think you're. I have a hard time hearing you too, Melody.
I don't understand.
But I can hear Eustace just fine. She's asking about your article about the history of the atomic bomb.
Oh, yes, that's very widely circulated. And right now I have an agent who's filing a case on this with the International Court in Hague, and he's going to prosecute that case for the Japanese people.
Is that right? Okay.
Oh, yes.
Well,
I've lectured in Japan a number of times and told the people about this, and they're very anxious to get something done on it because Japan is still occupied by the United States Army, and the people there have no freedom at all. They're pressed and television, is completely controlled by the occupation government.
Yeah, wouldn't it be nice if some of these crimes were actually investigated and some people were actually held responsible?
Well, what has happened in my work is I've become a historian who only writes about crime. And most of these crimes never come to trial.
And most of these crimes do not come to trial, is that what you said?
That's exactly true.
Well, it seems like 911 fits that very description.
911 is a typical occurrence in the chain of circumstances of international terrorism. See, our Washington claims that they're fighting a war on terror, but the only terror in the world today comes out of Washington itself.
Comes out of Washington itself, yeah. And, of course, Washington is also in very much in cahoots, in cooperation with especially England or British Israel, you might say. So if you're looking for the perpetrators of 9-1-1, I think you might find some of the same terrorists who have committed some of these other crimes that you've talked about over the years, such as orchestrating World War I, World War II, Korean War, Vietnam War, probably the assassination of Kennedy. Would you agree with that?
Oh, yes, I certainly would. And the United States government has announced that they're going to prosecute the people who committed the attack on 9-1-1. But the only attackers were the people in Washington itself. And Bill Riley, the commentator for Rupert Murdoch's Fox News, criticized anyone who said that Washington had anything to do with 9-11. He was in a frenzy. He gets callers on his program, and people appear and ask why Washington isn't investigated on 9-11. And, of course, we had a 9-11 congressional commission which completely cleared Washington of any involvement. And that was our own congressman who filed this fake report that we had no part to play in 9-11.
Right, yeah. And those of us who've bothered to look at that report realize that it has almost no information in it. It starts with the conclusion. The premise is the conclusion that that 19 Arab hijackers and Osama bin Laden carried it out. And then what they do is they desperately try to find little tidbits of information that support that preposterous idea and then rule out all the other things that contradict it. And so it's, as a result, it's a fiction. It's a myth.
Most intelligence reports claim that Osama bin Laden died about 6 years ago in Pakistan. And
that makes sense. Yeah.
They still have a $25 billion reward for Osama bin Laden, but no one has been able to find him. And if the entire United States government cannot find one man in Asia, then what chance do they have?
Well, and not only that, but there's been a lot of work done on 9-1-1 research, and I myself have many, many books and videos about it, and two or three of them mention that on September 10th, Dan Rather is at a hospital in Rawalpindi, which is a military hospital which has got all kinds of ties to America. September 10th, 2001, Osama bin Laden is in the hospital getting kidney dialysis.
He was seriously ill at that time.
He was very seriously ill on September 11th. He may have died shortly thereafter.
And, that's right.
So they knew exactly where he was. But, of course, then there's this big story that goes out in the press that this is the most wanted man and we've got all our agents out after him and that sort of thing. And, of course, that's just a hoax as well.
Well, the current Washington story is that Osama bin Laden is hiding somewhere on the Pakistan border. Well, it seems very mysterious that all of the agencies at our command cannot find one man in Asia.
Over a period of 7 years of the most intensive manhunt supposedly in the history of the world.
Oh, yes, so, and the search has been intensified during that entire period, and yet they found no trace of him. And the general consensus is that bin Laden died about 6 or 7 years ago.
Right, yeah.
And so there's no way they can find a dead man.
So the goal then of the real terrorists, the real perpetrators of 9/11, would be what in your mind?
Oh, yes, it certainly is.
What is the purpose of the 9/11 operation?
Well, the 9/11 operation was advertised that it changed the world, and no one can see any evidence that our world has changed at all. It's essentially the same situation that occurred on 9/11, that the people are totally misinformed by what occurred, that there's no arrest or indictment of any perpetrators, because the people that they have indicted are people whom they have no evidence of any kind that they had anything to do with 9/11.
Yeah.
Well, Bill O'Reilly, the commentator whom Rupert Murdoch pays $10 million a year to be an Israeli propagandist, Bill O'Reilly goes into a fury when anyone calls in and mentions that perhaps George Bush or somebody in Washington had something to do with 9/11. He really almost goes out of his mind.
yeah. Well, what we see is a cabal with the Bush administration that's heavily influenced by a group of what we call neoconservatives. The neocons who are ideologically very close to the Trotskyites.
They are Trotskyites people. They were all Trotskyites. And in fact, William Buckley, who recently died, was the publisher of the magazine The National Review, which was the Trotskyite publication. It was almost entirely staffed by Trotskyites.
Well, this is a most confusing world. I can understand why people don't understand it. If you have supposedly right wing politics.
Well, they were supposedly the American right wing, and the National Review was never anything except an Israeli propaganda magazine and a pseudo CIA house magazine.
Well, yeah, most people would consider the Bush administration to be, you know, pretty far right, and most people would consider Trotsky to be pretty far left, actually, communist. But to have the neocons be so similar to the Trotskyites means that these labels, right and left, have lost their meaning, wouldn't you say?
Oh, well, the Israeli neocons have never shown any interest in America or sympathy for America. They have continued to publish the Israeli propaganda and Trotskyite propaganda, and that's all they do.
Yeah.
They don't print anything which is not pure, unadulterated, invented propaganda. So people have no protection from that at all, because they read the National Review and they think they're getting an accurate presentation.
And what they're getting is propaganda, yeah.
Oh, yes.
Yeah. Well, I've got an interesting article about the perpetrators, or what one person or what a group of people put together as their best estimate of who are the 9/11 co-conspirators. And they've identified 103 people who are likely to be suspects in 9/11, and they include a lot of these neocons like Paul Wolfowitz.
Oh yes, they were all together. Billy Crystal and all those neocons.
Dov Zakheim, Douglas Faith, of course, George Bush, Dick Cheney.
Oh, Douglas Faith had a front page story in the Washington Post yesterday. He's very prominent.
I'm sorry, I didn't get that.
Oh, Douglas Faith had a front page story printed in the Washington Post yesterday.
Yeah.
More of his propaganda.
Yeah. Well, these are all Zionists.
Yes.
And many of them have.
Well, the Washington Post is a Zionist newspaper.
Yeah.
You'll never say a word of a criticism of Israel in the Washington Post. And that is the paper that all our congressmen read in Washington.
Right, right. Anyway, this article I've got goes through names of 103 people who they think are involved as co-conspirators, and then they do an interesting little summary at the end, and they say that of these people, 34 of the 103 are former corporate executives, which is 33%. 27 are either Israelis or Zionists, and that makes up 26.2% of these co-conspirators, or what they think are co-conspirators. So if you look at the two largest groups within this groupings, you see corporate executives, and you see Israelis and Zionists. Which I think
And the United States have never convicted any one of them of anything.
That's right. And, of course, the problem of the unsolved crime, the unpunished crime, such as the Kennedy assassination. Have you read the Michael Collins Piper's book, Final Judgment?
Oh, yes. I Michael Collins Piper is a close friend of mine, and I read all of his books, and I've appeared on his radio program.
Okay. You would agree then with his conclusion that Mossad had a lot to do with
Yes. He was the one who came out with that information, and it's never been challenged by anybody.
Yeah, and this is another unsolved crime, isn't it?
Oh, it definitely is a crime.
Yeah. So what we have is a lot of crimes and not very many people brought to justice. It's really quite phenomenal. But then I guess if you own the press, and if you own or your team owns the press and they own the banks, that's a distinct advantage. You can pay Bill O'Reilly $10 million a year, too. And you can pay Pat Robertson and Joe
Falwell. Pat Robertson was one of the worst. I went to school with Pat Robertson at Washington Lee University. But when I knew him, he wasn't active in any Christian endeavor whatsoever. That didn't come to some years later.
This was at Washington University?
Washington Lee in Lexington,
Washington Lee.
Virginia.
Yeah.
See, Pat lived in Lexington. His father was Congressman Willis Robertson, who was the chairman of the House Banking Committee. He was acquainted with all of the principal bankers on Wall Street.
Maybe that's why Pat Robertson was always so interested in the Fortune 700. Is that right?
Oh, yes. And that's how Pat Robertson was able to finance this big nationwide television network, because that takes a lot of money. And then he and his son, Tim, sold the network, which was financed by contributions from the public. And they sold the network for $750 million, which Pat Robertson and his son spent between them.
Wow. Well, that's a little nepotism there, is that right? Okay, so what do we do? How do we attack this octopus?
We can't attack the octopus, because the octopus has too many arms. You can't chop them all off. They're everywhere.
Okay. So you can't attack the octopus, but you haven't given up. So what do you recommend that people do?
Well, I try to tell the American people as much of the information about this to alert them to the peril that they're in.
Yeah, which is which is why you're willing to stay up so late on a Tuesday night. We sure appreciate it.
Oh, yes, it's a pretty late for me because I'm getting pretty old for staying. I had my 78th birthday a few days ago.
Yeah, I can understand, Melody. This show is at a tough time for people on the East Coast. But we appreciate you hanging in and obviously very committed to getting the word out. So, okay, get the word out, talk to people. What else can we do? Write articles?
Well, I do a lot of public speaking on this.
Uh-huh.
You do a lot of radio programs, too.
I do a lot of radio programs and question and answer programs, everything.
I'm still a little interested in that one article that you wrote on, or a book, I'm not sure which, on the murder by injection and the Great Swine Flu Massacre. Can you talk about that a little bit?
That's the only history of the American Medical Association. When I went to the Library of Congress to look up the American Medical Association, there was not a single book in the Library of Congress about it. And it was the most powerful lobby in Washington. So I wrote The Murder by Injection, and that helped a little bit.
Well, give us a little information as to why that's so significant.
The American people are being mass poisoned by the various chemical drugs that are being forced on them by the doctors. See, the American Pharmaceutical Manufacturers Association is a big lobby in Washington. And they're putting all these chemical drugs out on to the people, and they have been properly tested, and there are a lot of deaths from that, and a lot of adverse physical reactions.
But what did it have to do with the swine flu after World War One or during World War One, one or the other? Did you hear me?
No, I didn't get.
What did it have to do with these World War One and the swine flu, and the injections?
World War One was introduced the use of chlorine, and they used chlorine gas in World War One, and then after the war they had large stocks of it that they couldn't dispose of, and so they decided to use that chlorine to supposedly purify the water, and the chlorinated water introduced fatal heart attacks in 40% of the American men.
That's the first I'd ever heard of that. And any other, I mean, when you're speaking of injection, did that have to do with vaccinations? Eustace?
Yeah.
Did that have to do with vaccinations?
Vaccinations?
Mm-hmm.
That produces autism in babies, you know. And they're crippled for life because they have a serious brain damage. And I've met a number of victims of autism, and they're crippled for life because there just is no cure.
Is this where the vaccinations originated?
Pardon?
Is this where the vaccinations originated? Was back in
They originated principally in England.
Okay.
And they were imported here and adopted by the United States.
And I suppose it helps the empire if the people in the colonies aren't too rebellious, and maybe they would have
well, that's
motivation.
Well, that's true.
Yeah. Would have a motivation to increase things like these kinds of diseases. It's kind of an ugly thought, but it would appear to be very possible and probable, in fact. Well, in terms of where we are right now on the kind of the trajectory in this worldwide revolutionary conspiracy, how do you see us? What is our best defense to hold on to our national sovereignty, to hold on to the Christian values.
Our position is critical at the present time because the American dollar has lost almost all of its value, and we're heavily in debt, and the people have no answer to anything.
The people what?
The people have no answer to any of these problems.
Yeah. So you're not thinking that if we can put Hillary or Barack in office that things are going to improve or get solved?
Well, as long as we have Hillary and Obama, we have some hope, I guess.
Okay, so we'll have more hope than you think with one of those two. And of those two, which one do you think would guide this country in a better direction?
People are not going to get that opportunity because Obama and Hillary have offered no solution to any problem in this country, even though Hillary claims she has experience and Obama doesn't really claim anything. But neither one of them are going to help the people of this country.
Would you suggest, then, that the best solution is to work on the local level in terms of local politics?
The local level is let people begin to work to save themselves on the local level. That's their best bet.
Yeah.
Certainly nothing's going to come out of Washington that will help them in any way.
Right.
Although they have promised to send out in May a $400 check to the American citizen, and this $400 check will enable them to pay off the $2 million mortgage.
Right, right. Yeah. Well, it seems to me trying to work at the local level also has lots of challenges now, but we have a little better chance of actually affecting some change. So.
Well, what do you do? And certainly you're not going to get anything done on the state capitals or at Washington itself.
Yeah.
The state capitals are all run from Washington and because of the government budget.
What would you say is the importance of the oil and gas industry in terms of dictating the direction of this country right now?
What direction is the gas and oil going?
Yeah, I mean, it seems like oil, Cheney and Bush are oil men and gas men, and it seems like the policies that they have instituted have been very, very, very lucrative. They have fit the oil and gas industry's needs. I mean, do you see that as a major power influence in Washington?
I don't think he's caught you on that.
Did you understand what I was saying there?
Oh, no, I didn't understand the question.
Okay, I was just asking about we have these powerful lobbies, the Jewish lobbies, extraordinarily powerful. What about the oil and gas lobby, you know, Exxon, Rockefellers, in terms
of... Oh, they're the most powerful lobbies because they have millions of dollars to spend.
So in terms of influence, you'd say the oil and the gas industry is right at the very top, right up there with the bankers.
It is because they have money enough to pay off all of the senators and congressmen.
Pay off all the congressmen? Yeah.
Oh, they buy them wholesale.
Yeah.
Well, I guess what we might want to kind of summate the evening here with Eustace and probably let him get some shut-eye here. And so do you got any closing comments, Eric and Eustace?
Oh, I don't have any closing comments that are particularly hopeful.
Well, I guess, yeah.
We just have to try to survive in an occupied country. See, the South went through the same thing after the Civil War. We were occupied by the federal government and more or less have been occupied ever since. A state representation is really a joke because the state capitals are simply offices of the Washington government.
That's interesting. And you, Eric, do you have any closing questions for him?
Well, I would just like to say that I think if you get into some of Eustace's books and whatnot, it's possible to see the big picture. And I'll just kind of say that to our listeners and suggest that they look into these things and then check out what you see in his books against other books and other sources. Because it is a very, very it's a confusing time. It's very difficult to understand what's going on. A lot of people have fuzzy feelings that something's not right, but they don't know who their enemy is. They think their enemy is, Osama bin Laden or 19 Arab hijackers, et cetera. We are told, we're jerked around by the media. And to look behind the curtain, I think you really need to dig, or you need to find somebody else who has really dug, and then let them be your guide, let them be your ally and helper, and then... So I very much thank Eustace for all the work he has done and is doing to educate people because, speaking as a college professor, we at the academy, we at universities can be very ignorant of these things also. I've been ignorant of most of these things all my life, and I'm starting to learn about them now, and I'm 58. So, better late than never, but... you have to dig, and you have to really want to find out the truth, because you're not going to get it by watching TV or reading the newspaper. So I guess I would just say that I think that Eustace gives us a means of understanding what's going on, which is very powerful. And for myself, I find that. By reading other books, I come up with the same kinds of conclusions, so therefore it seems to hold together. Then the question, of course, is how do we respond, and how do we fight back, how do we try to hold on to our sovereignty, whatever. And that's the big question. I have already asked you that, Eustace, so I don't know if you have any more thoughts on that or not. But
We've got to start organizations on the local level before we can get anything done. And just now we don't have the organizations.
Yeah, get connected at the local level, yeah.
Oh, yes.
Well, I'd like to go ahead and close and finish up with some public service announcements and let you two gentlemen... in the evening here, and I want to thank both of you for contributing to the program tonight, and we tried something a little bit new and different, so we were able to upgrade our phone system, so now that we can have our co-host stay at home in Crestone and then call around the country for our guests. And so I want to say good night with both of you, and I really appreciate both you coming on, and good evening.
Okay, thanks, Melody, and certainly thanks to you, Eustace, and especially for staying up so late. I kind of apologize for that, but we sure appreciate the opportunity to have this conversation.
Well, I know these Western States stations broadcast a lot later than we do on the East Coast here, but
yeah.
It's worth it to get to reach some people out there.
Well, thank you very much again, Eustace.
Okay,
you're welcome.
Good night, Eustace.
Good night.
So much again. Okay.
All right.
Good night.
Good night.
Bye-bye.
Good night.